Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. This interview was also recorded in high-definition video and can be viewed at mormonstories.org, on YouTube at youtube.com/mormonstories, and in iTunes as part of the podcast feed. There's some notes in there that I wrote about how wonderful it would be from a woman's perspective to be married to a gay man. Here's a man who,
you're right.
Here's a man who was a fabulous cook.
Yep.
He was the one helping you decorate the home.
Oh yeah.
Their favorite game together was name that author or what,
oh,
what
yeah,
was it
authors,
called?
Oh yeah, authors, yeah.
What was it called? Authors?
Just authors. You know, a card game authors.
He's probably a fantastic listener.
Yes. Absolutely.
Sensitive. The perfect best friend.
Of course.
Everything that a good female best friend would be to another female.
Totally.
Plus he's your husband.
Yeah. And gay men are good for absolutely everything except to be married to a heterosexual woman.
Imagine how good a bishop, how good a gay man would be as a bishop.
There have been gay men who have been bishops. Well, yeah, our gay men, and, you know, I speak mostly of our gay men, and sometimes to the letting, not bringing in the lesbians the way that they need to be able to participate in this kind of conversation. Because my experience has been primarily not only with Gerald, but with mostly with gay men as friends. And the majority of those who have come into my life. But the qualities that they have are very desirable qualities, not in spite of, but because of the fact that they have this unusual emotional, sexual kind of experience that is built into them. And you see, many cultures acknowledge the richness that these unusual people can bring to them. And I mentioned in No More Goodbyes, having read that, you know, some indigenous cultures have a special name for them, a special place, an honored place for them as the Two-Spirit, is that what I forget what I called them there, what I had read. But gay men would have an unusual richness that, because in our Mormon culture now, we either throw them out, treat them in a way that they voluntarily leave, or demand that they behave like straight men. Our culture is enormously deprived of gifts that they would bring. Hey, do you think you can have a really good music program and not have gay men involved in it? Not on your life. Or theater.
I have no business sharing a story, but I'm going to share a very brief story.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago when I interviewed Bruce Bastian, I said, if I could give you a pill or fix you, or if some young man wanted to be fixed, shouldn't we invest in research to help that man get fixed? If there could be a way to splice into the DNA and fix that gay gene, if there's a gay gene. And of course, that's when he got most angry in the whole time that we were talking together. But his comment was, I don't want to be fixed. I don't need to be fixed. All the wonderful things I've been able to do to create this marvelous company that employed 7,000 people, brought in $500 million a year, was in part because of who I was, and part of who I was this gay thing. And I'm like, I'm not sure I quite bought it, Bruce. You know, I didn't say that, but like in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't know. I was having lunch with a very good friend last week. He told me the story about how in Russia, they breed foxes because foxes have beautiful fur. And it gets cold in Russia, and there are a lot of good uses for beautiful fox fur. But it turns out that foxes are incredibly nasty creatures, mean and vicious. And so they said, well, we've been doing genetics for a long time. Let's just naturally select the nice foxes and we'll slowly breed this you know, dynamic out of them. So they bred the foxes and bred the foxes and they bred the foxes towards a certain area where they wanted to go. And two things happened. Number one is they came to look a lot like dogs. Just like dogs.
Wow.
And guess what the second thing was?
Uh-oh, what?
Their fur was no longer beautiful.
Yeah.
And so genetically altering them in a way that you think you're wiser, in a direction that you think is wiser, took away the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Right.
Forgive me for that.
No, no, I know.
Maybe you can use that story.
No, that pertains here. Absolutely, John, I understand. I think that often we think we are so much smarter than nature and that we can modify nature to the way that we think it really ought to be, and sometimes, frequently, we make such errors. We're modifying our food. We're changing the whole face of the planet in ways that are clearly so incorrect. And I think that with the human being and with this subject that we're speaking of, to look at those among us who are of homosexual orientation and say, oh boy, I got to fix that. How do we know? There may be some wisdom in nature, because this evidences in everywhere in nature, hundreds and hundreds of species evidence this. And there, what gay people can bring to the table are unusual gifts that I think we ought not to tamper with, but appreciate.
And that made Gerald, in some ways, a very delightful husband.
Gerald was a very delightful human being and a good husband and a fun, fun father. You know, we later on, there are all kinds of difficult things thrown into the mix that were very challenging for my children. And Gerald made unwise choices in a lot of ways. But he was a very caring husband and father, and really a fun father. My friend's kids were just so envious of them having such a fun father who was there for them so, so often.
And in addition to his love for art and music and theater, you got the sense that he was really wrestling intellectually with everything.
Oh, yes.
Like, one of the things that really stood out in the book is how he was almost seemingly trying to construct a theology that would be compatible
with
who he was.
Absolutely.
Do you remember that?
Oh, well, forever. That was part of his ongoing struggle forever. Knowing that who he was, his homosexual orientation was so at odds with everything he saw out here, certainly in the church, that he read and just studied everything he could come upon. And in the 70s, you know, when the quote New Age burst upon us, Gerald was among the first to grab these tools of meditation and learning about Eastern ways of looking at things and trying to figure out who he was. Oh yeah, Gerald was voracious.
And as he was, there are a couple. Can I grab the book back?
Sure.
There are a couple points in the book where he's coming to you with poems or with scriptures or with theological ideas, where he's clearly, as I read it, communicating to you, I'm still gay, but there's got to be a theology that brings us together. And he'll lay it, he'll kind of gently, you're in bed together, whatever, he'll lay it to you and say, here's how I'm seeing it. Maybe it's not just man and woman, but maybe it's something even more expansive.
Yes. And anytime any of those little windows would be opened, I would shut them really, really fast. I mean, if I would shut the polygamy window really fast, I'm certainly going to shut every other odd window fast really, really rapidly.
Which is strange for someone who also considers herself progressive. You were also very traditional in some ways.
Oh, yes. And, you know, the thing of open marriage was, that book called Open Marriage in the 70s, and there were all these experiments of whatever. I never, ever had any, there was nothing in me that could validate anything but an exclusive, committed relationship.
Sure.
Ever.
Yeah. And did you, one of the things that fascinates me is when things happen in the undercurrent of a couple, of a marital relationship, and they're just not discussed and they're not contemplated. And so I'm clearly seeing a man trying to say, Carolyn, I'm still gay. This hasn't gone away.
Right. And of course,
I've got to make it right.
Of course. And I was writing all that after the fact, along the way, as I saw anything that would remind me of what might still be in Gerald. A little moment of terror would make it so horrific.
You talk about a chill. You mention a chill a lot, a feeling of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when there's something threatening that comes from any direction, there's something in your stomach that lets you know, ooh, whatever this is, you got to handle it, or it's coming. Yes, there was a lot. And when Gerald made me read D.H. Lawrence, what, Women in Love? Is that, I'm sure that's mentioned in there, that talks about the intense physical relation. And I don't even know if that was in specifically sexual relationship, but these two men who gave each other something that a woman could not.
Yeah. I want to turn quickly. We would be remiss before we jump into more of Gerald's story to not talk about how he helped you make yours.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a poem that I want you to read as a way to introduce his support for the book Beginnings that he helped you first publish, your first book.
Oh, yeah.
Would you mind reading a little bit from that poem, or?
Well, sure. This is the title poem. May I just say how the book happened and then read this? As I have confessed to you, I was always writing these little poems to put in my file, poetry very bad, poetry not quite so bad. I just kept writing. And so as Gerald and I prior, and then as we were married, shared these poems that I had written, he was so excited. He was so enthusiastic. Bless him. I mean, that's what he called me all the way through. We've got to publish these. I mean, what crazy person, but a gay man, would come up with the idea of publishing his wife's poetry?
That's right.
But it was soon after our marriage that he got very serious. We've got to. And I thought, well, I thought like publish them posthumously or send them into the church magazines or whatever. But Gerald was insistent that we put together a manuscript. And so I did. And he got Trevor Southey, and he had become friends with Trevor before I did. He got Trevor to do these illustrations. And we got in the car one day and took it up to Salt Lake City to see who'd be first in line to publish this book of my poems. And we went to Marvin Wallen at Bookcraft, who sat us down in his office, and he didn't even look at anything. He said, you know, look, poetry is just not going to sell. And I think Gerald showed him one of Trevor's illustrations. Oh, that's very depressing.
There was a Shakespeare quote that I liked. If Shakespeare himself came out with a poetry book.
Oh.
Didn't you write that?
If that's what I
It's
see, I
in
don't
there.
remember everything
It's in
now, but
there.
if that's in there, it was said.
If Shakespeare came out with the book himself, we wouldn't publish it.
Well, yeah. And I said, why don't you just take the manuscript and let your wife read it? No. He didn't want to. So we went home, and I would, to my mind, it was done. And Gerald said, I can be a publisher. Anybody can be a publisher. So that's what happened. Gerald did all the footwork, and we went to Mountain States Bindery and had 2,000. Well, we borrowed money from the credit union. I was at that time, we're still working for the motion picture studio. And we borrowed $2,000 from the credit union, had 2,000 copies of this little book printed, and I remember when they were delivered, we had all these packages, and we put them in the closet and in my daddy's garage and under the bed. And it was really an outrageous thing. And I'm sure I thought, I've got a whole lifetime of wedding presents that I have to. And we went up to BYU bookstore, first of all. Well, no, I remember Gerald saying that somebody at the bindery. Now, see, keep in mind that I understand full well that what happened with Beginnings was a fluke. It was a fluke. It was maybe if I did have any kind of fate or path that I and the angels were developing for some work that I might have to do, that was what opened the door. I'm fully aware that the fact that Beginnings sprang upon the Mormon community in 67 and was such an unusual hit. That was a strange thing. That was a fluke. It surprised me as much as anybody else. But Gerald told me when he picked up the books from the bindery, the man at the bindery said something like, boy, we've had a hard time with this book. The people just keep sitting there and reading it and telling each other to look at this poem and that poem. And then, so we took the book up to BYU bookstore, and the buyer there said, well, you know, poetry won't sell, but since you're a local person, why don't you leave, what'd you say, 5 or something on consignment? And Gerald said, well, they come in packages of 20, so leave a package on consignment. We'll come back and get the rest.
And it was that person who made the Shakespeare quote. It was that person.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So she took a package and put up a display, and either the next day or the day after that, she called and said, you know that book that you left up here, do you have any more of those? So we took up more. We went to the 70s bookstore, and then pretty soon to Deseret bookstore, and just like immediately, everybody was buying this book. And there were, early on, I know there were months where Deseret Book routinely ordered about 500 copies a month. And we sold about 20,000 copies of that before we did even the slightest amount of advertising. I mean, it really was weird. And I understand that it was a weird, fluky thing. It was... It had Mormon thought in it, but it wasn't necessarily only specifically Mormon. But it spoke to Mormon people, and especially Mormon women. But, you know, a lot of men, too, were really appreciating it. And so that's just what happened.
So read us that.
Oh,
a little bit of it, if
yeah.
you don't mind.
Yeah, okay.
I love it. Set this one up, because if people are slow like me, they'll appreciate knowing what the poem is going to be about before they hear it, so they can savor the words in the context and
yeah.
not have to read it the second
well,
time. So what's this one about?
This one is about eternal growth. And the illustration for this poem is the one, I don't have that original book with me, white book, red letters, Beginnings, and Trevor's beautiful illustration there called God in Embryo of an adult male in embryo position. And so this is the title poem, Beginnings. Today you came running with a small specked egg warm in your hand. You could barely understand, I know. As I told you of beginnings, of egg and bird, told too that years ago you began smaller than sight. And then, as egg yearns for sky and seed stretches to tree, you became like me. Oh, but there's so much more. You and I, child, have just begun. Think, worlds from now, what might we be? We, who are seed of deity. So these little verses just spoke to a lot of people.
It's a very Mormon poem right there. It's sort of touching on some of the most expansive, probably the most expansive Mormon doctrine.
Right. Yeah.
Of theosis.
Yeah. This is true. And I still don't know why this little book became so popular. Beginnings, it sold well over 150,000 copies. But it spoke to people in a way that hadn't. And I don't fool myself that I know these are not museum quality poems that a century from now will be looked at as whatever. But my poems have been very useful for people. And that's a word that I like. My stuff has been very, very useful. And there's some poems that are pretty good poems. BYU professor Clinton Larson was known to say, Carolyn Pearson has put Mormon art back 50 years. But nevertheless.
In a good way or a bad way?
Oh, in a bad way.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Put it back.
Oh, yeah. Because people accepted these simple little verses as what poetry really is.
Oh, because he's sophisticated.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. However, let me add that later on, when The Order Is Love came out, he called and told me what an absolutely wonderful play that was. So I don't want to say anything bad about it. But he was upset that my poems became very popular.
Well.
Honestly, this was an odd thing, how this happened, and this opened the door to everything else.
You know, I just have to ask, and I'm condemning myself here, how many Mormon men, then or now, would believe so much in a creative work of their wife?
Oh, no. No.
That they would sacrifice treasure and time to make sure, after rejection and rejection, to make sure that their wives' creative work sees the light of day. This is a miracle.
Only a dear queer man like I had. No, listen, John, really, I believe, I don't know that I believe in predestination. I don't think that everything has to be worked out here. But I am absolutely willing to say some of these things, we were being guided to let this happen and this happen and this. And so what it has turned out, you know, for me is the privilege of being able to have a real deep connection and hopefully positive impact on a lot of people. And you see, later on, when these poems were the first thing I did, and then I did some women's books, we'll talk about that, but when Gerald and I were in the midst of our worst struggling, and we never talked about the idea that I would ever write our story, even, you know, when everything was out between us and we were dealing with the worst of everything. But he said, Blossom, you know that you were not intended just to write simple little poems. You know that that was setting the foundation for you to do something much, much, much more important.
What's it like to have someone believe in you that much?
It's really nice.
And we should have started by saying he called you Blossom.
Yes, and I my tongue wouldn't quite, didn't want to say that because it would sound weird to people, but I don't remember him ever calling me Carolyn. I mean, I was named Magnolia Blossom Jones by my dear bad boy boyfriend at BYU, Larry, who gave me the name of Magnolia Blossom Jones, and he was Jazbo Jones, and we had this fun thing. Somehow, Gerald, a lot of my friends still call me Magnolia. A lot of my friends still call me Blossom. Gerald called me Blossom all the time.
So just to kind of build up to talking about the complications in the marriage, let's just quickly tell our viewers, listeners, a few more of the major creative works that you would have been involved in, you know,
early on
throughout throughout those years. So Beginnings built into.
Yes. And then I did a second book of poems called The Search, another called The Growing Season, and one called A Widening View. During that period of time, Doubleday took over Beginnings and The Search for a little period of time. And then Marv Wallen called us on the phone one day from Bookcraft and said, "Is that the book of poems that I turned down a long time ago?" And we said, "Yes, Brother Wallen." Well, boy, did I make a mistake there. So, Gerald had become a publisher and put out, and he put out a book of his own called There Is a Way Back, about his work and others with the Mormon hippie drug kids in Utah during the 70s. And various things like that. But we thought it might be wise to turn over the poems to Bookcraft. So we did. And then I started writing some of my books about feminism or about Mormon women. The first one being Daughters of Light, which I think Gerald and I first published and then turned over to Bookcraft, a compilation of stories of the early Mormon women exercising spiritual gifts, which I must pause to tell you, when I first discovered the history of Mormon women, when my dear friend Leonard Arrington, church historian, led us into knowledge of women's exponent and some of the things that early Mormon women had done. And I went to the library and read these wonderful old copies of the women's exponent and read about these strong, brilliant Mormon women. I was delighted and I was outraged. I was so thrilled to find these women, and I was outraged that nobody had ever told me about the women in Mormon history before.
What were some things women did back in the 19th century that would surprise us today?
Well,
anything come to mind?
Sure, that they, well, we know the Brigham Young sent many of them away to become doctors. Women, Mormon women were lawyers at a time when that just was not ever done. Women were, see, early Mormon women were friends to Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and participated in that whole wave of the suffrage movement. So I don't think we understand that.
How about in terms of ordinances or things that we would consider to be
right,
ordinances?
Well, yes. The early Mormon women, as we know, and some of the stories that I gathered that I put in Daughters of Light, Joseph Smith encouraged the women to lay on hands, to anoint with oil, to
heal the sick, right?
Yeah, to heal the sick. To the gift of tongues was known then, really pretty much as very much as a woman's gift. The gift of prophecy. There are so many stories that really would surprise us.
And how about washings and anointings?
Oh yeah. And it was clear through much of the early period in Utah. It was routine that before a woman went into labor, she was given a washing and an anointing and a blessing by the Relief Society sisters.
Just like kind of similar to the temple ceremony, oil was involved, right?
I believe so.
Different parts of the body were anointed.
I believe that's true.
With a prayer and oil.
Oh, yeah.
Part by part.
Yes, women there were a lot of doors open for women spiritually by Joseph Smith. And then the polygamy thing got all weird and messed up and shut a lot of those doors and put women in their place. And then, you know, the 19th century came along and a lot of fear developed. And then we had to make things correlated. And as the years went on, women lost more and more and more of their autonomy in terms of spiritual gifts, in terms of Relief Society, being able to chart their own course in any kind of way. Today, Relief Society women don't even write their own visiting teaching lessons at the top. There are a lot of awful stories we're not going to talk about.
So you wrote some books on some of these things?
Daughters of Light showed the spiritual gifts that women were involved in. And then I wrote a book called The Flight and the Nest that looked at what those early women were doing professionally, politically, educationally. And it was all new stuff that we didn't know all that was going on. And so those were important books. Some of the first things that were published as modern Mormon women were rediscovering their past. These were two important things. So.
And Gerald was supportive?
Oh, yes. Totally.
Did he have a job throughout all this?
Gerald was an entrepreneur. And the money that supported our family essentially came from the books of mine that we published. And he handled that and was into a lot of his own projects and ideas that didn't really take hold. Gerald was a dreamer, but he also was a doer. You know, he made beginnings happen. And he had a lot of his own things that he hoped to, his dreams that he wanted to bring to fruition that didn't ever happen.
So before we jump back into more of the complexity, I have one last observation. I have this impression that there was this time where literature and the arts were more heavily valued than maybe they are today. I've been told about something like Out of the Best Books or some type of series of books that, like, even Relief Society women were encouraged to read the classics,
John,
to read and discuss the classics.
John, you are so young.
Tell us about, because I'm trying to think about a poetry book in Mormonism selling 150,000 copies in 2010. No way. No way.
Oh, of course.
And just
right.
Thoughtful.
No, no. But a lot of who knows what the time dictates certain or that people's inner needs dictate what happens in a given time. And you're right that I think in Mormondom there has been a time where there was what? More richness in certain ways. Now, wait, I'm not sure I want to say that. I have to acknowledge that I'm not really up to date about contemporary Mormon art. There's an awful lot going on that's being published, good novels, good poetry, a variety of things that I know are of very good quality that would perhaps, as art, compare more favorably with a high standard of art than what was going on back where we're talking about. But there was, yes, I think, an openness and a kind of a richness to what art might mean for us institutionally. And because you mentioned, you said, it was such a thing as Out of the Best Books. Listen, I and so many women that I know yearn We look back with great fondness on those days when Relief Society actually acknowledged that women were women and had their own ideas, could speak to each other in a way that was not always dictated by men. Out of the Best Books was a series of books that were beautiful lessons were created by taking samples of literature from everywhere. Some Mormon stuff, if it happened to fit. Bruce Clark put several of my poems into one of those lessons when the Beginnings came out. But primarily, it was literature from all over the world, from all times, developing themes of whatever, of honesty, of integrity, of virtue, of whatever it was that the theme of the lesson was enriched by the literature of everywhere. And then we had, of course, the cultural refinement lesson.
Where what would you do with these lessons? Was this Relief Society?
Oh, yeah.
So your Relief Society curriculum
absolutely
was exploring the classics. It was like
was
a book
it.
Club.
Yeah.
It was like a book club with your Relief Society sisters.
Right. With a good theme to each lesson that was very consistent with whatever the gospel is supposed to be all about. That's what Out of the Best Books
was. Was it as marvelous as it seems like it might be?
It was. It was wonderful. I think I probably have all of those. There were at least 4 years that I remember, maybe more, where the text was this nice hardbound book called Out of the Best Books, Volume 1, 2, 3, or
and
whatever.
It's Dickens and...
Absolutely. Everything. It was great. And I think the institutional personality of the church, as I remember it, has, to some extent, had personality correlated right out of it. So that today, the priesthood and the Relief Society both share the same manual. And as I wrote into the correlation committee, I think about a year and a half ago, whenever we started, looking at the manual now that the priesthood and the Relief Society share puts me in mind of the old English law that said when two marry and become one, the one is he. So now that Relief Society and the priesthood are one, the one is he, meaning that there is no real attempt to acknowledge that women are speaking to each other or being spoken to. The language is still all male. A lot of female richness has just been taken right out of much of the experience.
It's a totally different culture now as it relates to literature and the arts.
Yeah. And theater, which was really such an integral part of a kid's growing up in Mormondom, the road shows, and really in one of the texts that we had when I was a theater student at BYU, it said in the book, the most successful widespread little theater movement in the country is the LDS Church. And that was true at that time. Everybody did plays.
The cultural hall was a cultural hall.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And even those silly little road shows were wonderful in what they did, in bringing together people to be in the spotlight, to create their own silly thing or whatever, and do the costuming and the makeup and travel around from here to there. That was wonderful.
And Stakes would put on musicals and plays, and you'd go to
absolutely
the Stakes Center and you'd
and
watch a beautiful...
And every once in a while that happens now, but it's rare. It is really, really rare. Maybe 5 years ago, maybe more, the Sacramento Stake invited me to come see my play, The Order is Love, which Lex de Azevedo and I did, a story of the Mormons living in the United Order. It's really a good play. And I went to see their performance just because I thought I should. But I sat there having the best time. And I saw Mormonism on every one of its really excellent layers of the the portrayal of the community that the United Order insisted upon, where everybody was part of the community in a really important way, that they were taken care of and they gave what they could. Seeing all that acted out, along with the community of the theater, bringing the people from all over the stake into their own little theatrical United Order to give what they had to give. And I was told that the director, everybody who tried out was given something to do in the play. Not one person was said they couldn't participate. And they had some people who had some limitations that were a little bit evident. But it was a thrilling thing to me to see those people with their limitations having a place to be. And see, that's, if there's one thing that is the brilliance of the Mormon idea, it's this community. That when it happens well, it happens really, really well. And then as we'll, I'm sure we'll get into, if you don't really belong to that community, it can be horrid. But, occasionally a stake will do a musical. But it's not like it used to be.
And I should add that you penned My Turn on Earth.
Yeah.
Was that the first sort of mainstream hit Mormon musical?
The Order is Love was the first kind of contemporary Mormon musical that gathered much attention. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And that was just about the time that Gerald and I and our four children moved from Provo to Walnut Creek. And Lex came knocking on my door saying, I want to put some of your poems to music. But that didn't ever really happen. But what happened was that I had written this play. In my late 20s is when I wrote that play. And Leonard Arrington helped me with some of the historical stuff. It's a really good play. And it was given a premiere at BYU Arts Festival. Lauren Wheelwright was in charge of, was the dean then. And so that was a kind of a big deal. But Lex and I did do My Turn on Earth, which was an unusual hit. And it's a really good little story. And at that time, we could kind of do some advertising within the Mormon network. And Lex put together a touring company of that went through the West, well, I know Arizona and Nevada and Utah and California at least. And it was very successful. And the word was out. And that gave me that year enough money to put a down payment on a house that was happening just at the time that Gerald and I were about to decide that the marriage was no longer sustainable. So that was, yeah, My Turn on Earth. And it still is being done occasionally, not nearly as much as it was because of the same thing that I mentioned. There's so much going on. Well, in the culture, there's so much going on for kids anyway. Nobody has time left over. And then the things that are demanded of the church that are, you know, just specifically have to be done, church things, doesn't leave much time for fun stuff.
Right.
Like putting on a play.
My family loves that musical, My Turn on Earth.
It's good. Yeah, it
it is. So let's turn back to Gerald a little bit.
Yeah.
So he's supporting you in your career, trying to do his own creative endeavors as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some point was trying to build this theology that would accommodate him.
Yeah.
But at some point, he develops, I don't know, I guess there's a poem I want you to read again. There's a point where he turns to you and talks to you about a Walt Whitman poem about breaking free. And I thought maybe you could read.
Sure. And, you know, my memory doesn't immediately.
I think you'll remember this.
I was grateful that Gerald had so much to give, and only occasionally did his generous spirit trouble me. Only occasionally did the storms that sometimes heaved within him cause me concern. Now and then I glimpsed something behind the light in his eyes that I did not understand. One night before going to sleep, he read aloud passionately a poem by Walt Whitman. Halfway through, I felt that strange chill in my stomach. Why was his voice so excited? Oh, to speed where there is space enough and air enough at last, to be absolved from previous ties and conventions, to escape utterly from others' anchors and holds, to drive free, to love free, to dash reckless and dangerous, to court destruction with taunts, with invitations, to ascend, to leap to the heavens of the love indicated to me, to rise thither with my inebriate soul, to be lost if it must be so, to feed the remainder of life with 1 hour of fullness and freedom, with 1 brief hour of madness and joy. Isn't that incredible? Gerald leaned back and closed his eyes.
And I bet you were terrified.
Oh, yes. Anything that spoke to me of his huge spirit going in a direction that I knew did not include me. And probably about this time he was becoming inactive in the church, not wearing his garments, things like that, all of which sent this huge terror through me. So, yeah, it was a scary time for me, yeah.
And it seems like during this time, he's trying to explore with you the idea of maybe an open marriage or having, I don't know that you ever said that explicitly, but I had a friend come to me a couple of years ago and tell me that his wife was gay, was lesbian, but that they were going to try and make it work and that he was going to allow her to have relationships, but she would still be intimate with him. And that somehow they would find a way to stay together, but let her be who she needed to be and explore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it almost sounded like he was trying at some point to see if you might be flexible.
I'm sure that's true. We didn't have an exact conversation like this early on, but a couple of years later, as we had moved to Walnut Creek and everything was, you know, just truly looking like we could not salvage a marriage. Gerald truly was clearly wishing and talking to me about the idea that you know, almost like my old seminary teacher had said, if we are worthy enough and it advanced enough, we will understand polygamy. Gerald was saying to me a similar kind of thing, that if I was sufficiently understanding and loved him enough and could see the whole picture, I might be able to participate in a relationship where he could have this other life and me too. And I never got even close to believing that I could do it or that it was a correct thing. Never.
And you get the sense that around this time or later, he might have been involved in some private relationships you weren't aware about. Is that?
Well, only when it exploded and somebody came and told me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And let's, that was a very powerful part of the book for me. So there's this point in the book where a mutual friend comes to your door and has some news to deliver to you.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember?
Well, that was the end of my life. That was the end of life as I knew it.
What happened?
Well, there was this young woman who was one of the many that Gerald and I had befriended of troubled young kids. And she told me that she had something she had to tell me, and she was kind of shaking. She was just, I don't want to even tell you this, but you need to know that she had seen Gerald up at the gay bar in Salt Lake, the Sun, and had a conversation with him. And the implication was that yes, he had been hoping to change. He has never been able to change, and my life just ended. Everything fell on the floor. I was in absolute broken, devastated pieces. Gerald was away at that time, going to a seminar, a spiritual seminar of some kind in San Francisco. And I remember I walked down the stairs to his office and I called him on the phone and got him. And I asked him, I said, Gerald, I don't know quite how I put it.
Gerald, since you and I have been married, have there been any men?
Yeah. And so he said yes. And then I said, what do you want to do? Do you want, is this marriage over or whatever? And he said, how could you think that? I can't imagine not being with you in the family. And then we just agreed to talk about it when he came back. And then maybe 4 days, I had 4 days to be alone with my children. And if I remember correctly, I had a speaking engagement at BYU the next day. After not sleeping, I had to go speak about something about women to women. I, this hypocrite whose life was in shambles, was up there talking to women about whatever I was talking to them about. A friend who was... Okay, who came in to help us with the kids during that time, she remembers well. Well, she says that during those days, I didn't open the curtains once. And I just did what I had to do to get through the day. And then Gerald came home, and he and I went into the back bedroom, and I hugged him, and he hugged me, and we just cried and cried. And then we just, you know, started trying to figure out what can we do. And it took 2 years in Provo and then a move to, and I was, we had to sell our house in Walnut Creek for various reasons, business stuff. And it was I who said, look, as long as we are moving, let's move. Let's really move. Let's move to California. Gerald never dreamed that I would actually say, let's move out of Utah. And one of the reasons, well, there were several. I wanted a new look at the world, but I thought that very likely we would be ending the marriage, and I didn't want to. You know, I was something of a public person in Utah, and I did not want to play out in front of the whole community a divorce, and them knowing about Gerald, and because I knew what the only understanding of this difficult subject was just 100% condemnation. And I didn't want that for either one of us to have to play out whatever we were going to play out in Utah. So we moved to Walnut Creek, and then for two additional years, struggled to find a way to save the marriage. And then it just became clear that we could not. And we divorced in 78. And committed to remain good friends, which we were able to do.
Yeah, you talk about how when you found out about Gerald, your father was dying. And you mentioned envying him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh.
You said, I was envious of my father as he was dying. He was going to die soon.
Yeah. And I mentioned in No More Goodbyes, I have never, ever considered suicide. Nobody ever need worry about that for me. But there have been at least 3 points in my life where I wanted everything to end, all being to cease.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Still.